those domains, but also those domains who are useful to magnetize those magnetized or disoriented domains affect the strength of the magnet. By that, if we go to the position of the atoms in the lattice, in the structure crystalline of the magnet, we may say that if we affect, for some reason, the position of those atoms, we actually see the magnetizing of the permanent magnet in time. Entry.
Yes, as I mentioned before, if you disrupt the structure of the lattice and the grains in relation to the magnetic dipole moments, you undermine the uniform alignment and decrease the strength. Now, keep in mind that a lot of people kind of think in terms of the old horseshoe magnet. You apply a strong magnetic field, you have it aligned this way, you apply another strong external magnetic field, you can get it oriented another way. You can make the poles go back and forth and all kinds of fun stuff. But there are magnets, unfortunately, that don't allow for that for sundry interesting but kind of confusing reasons. Neodymium magnets that everyone knows and loves by now cannot simply be you cannot take a kind of formed neodymium magnet and apply an external magnetic field and get the strong magnet that we know and love. You have to apply an external magnetic field before you sinter the material. Otherwise, the alignments will not be enough to produce as strong a magnet as neodymium alloys are able to do.
Yeah, so we may ask another question, which would be similar in nature. Why does the magnet never run out of its energy, even though that is used continuously for a long period of time?
Again, it's not using its energy. It would be akin to the same question of if you put a lead weight on the floor and it sits there producing a force down on the floor for 100 years, why does the lead ball weigh the same amount? Shouldn't it lose weight because it's using energy, which it's not? So it's the same problem. Your magnet is not using its magnet energy. It's using other things like kinetic energy and other forms of energy transducing it. It's not using up the alignment energy of its magnetic dipole moments.
Can we hear magnetic domain switching?
I guess theoretically you would have to rig up some kind of strange device that measured magnetic field variations and then amplified them and such. I'm not quite sure what the purpose for that would be.
Yeah, we can have a microphone that is glued or taped into the magnetized material. And we can run another magnet next to it, or doesn't have even have to be a magnet. It could be just a material that can be magnetized, and we can run magnet into it, and we can hear those mechanical sound of the magnetic domains switching in a magnet. We can also hear it in ferrite. So another question is, what is the ferrite? What is the difference between regular ferrite and a magnet? And to experience.
Okay. Unfortunately, there's two types of ferrite, just to make life more complicated than it already is. There's hard ferrite, there's soft ferrite. But I like soft ferrite. Soft ferrite is what we use on toroids and balans and all. So I will address this for the soft ferrites. The beauty of soft ferrites is that it has less hysteresis losses because it doesn't get stuck. Ferromagnetic materials often will get stuck. You apply an external magnetic field, some of the fields align, you then discontinue the external magnetic field, and you still have a background magnetic field because that material is somewhat sticky for developing an alignment in its magnetic dipole moments. Soft ferrites do not. If you turn off an external electromagnetic field or turn off a magnet, whatever, external, it will bounce back to a neutral position. It will not hold on to an external magnetic field's alignment when the external magnetic field is broken.
Yeah, as far as the ferrite that we use, it has a few properties. One of them is permeability, and the highest permeability of that material, the lower the frequency that the material could work at. Typical of 2000, permeability of 2000 gives us approximately about 500 kilohertz of frequency that core could be applied to. It is made a quite easy way. We take iron filing in the large amount of it, and we put it into the ceramic jar that is rotating, and we pour the water in it. After 24 hours, those individual grains of the filings are rusted, and the rust makes them not conducting electricity. And then you take out the water, dry them, and then put into the form. So that could be a form of the transformer a core or the ring or whatever form we need to. And then we use a little bit of bonding compound, and we put the pressure on it. Now we have a green stage of the ferrite, and that green stage of the ferrite is then put into the oven at a high temperature, makes us the ferrite. Now we put when we put the ohmmeter in it, we see that the resistance of it is humongous. So this thing is not conducting electricity. There's a few words about how the ferrite is made. Question. How is then that ferrite is not permanently magnetized? It's just holding that magnetism for a certain period of time. Interesting.
Okay. It's because it's not native iron anymore. It's an iron oxide. It's an oxidation state of iron that changes its magnetic qualities, more than just the permeability. Again, there is different values for different material. Some of them get stuck when you align them, and some don't get stuck. Paramagnetic is another example of material that will respond and be attracted by magnetic material, but if you remove the magnet material, it itself does not hold on to magnetism. So because of the oxidation state of the iron, it changes from a ferromagnetic material to what's called a ferri magnetic material, with the ability to kind of lose its orientation with very little energy loss and gain, and that's what produces a decrease in the hysteresis losses. If it held tenaciously on to its previous magnetic field, reversing it would require extra energy that would be dissipated as heat.
A few other words about it. magnet has south pole, north pole, and black hole. What is black hole?
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. Obviously, there's a point in the middle where it doesn't demonstrate any particular polarity. Of course, everyone remembers their Maxwell's equations, where the diversion of a magnetic field is zero. Every force line that goes out has to go back in. There's no stray field lines that go outside of the local magnetic field of a magnet.
And that is exactly called black hole, B-L-O-O-H, wall. Now, the last thing, because we're soon going to space report, is at low temperature, we have a frozen magnetic flux. How does it work? Enter here.
Okay, not quite sure what you're alluding to. If I was a guessing man, which fortunately for both of us I am, I would assume that you're vaguely alluding to type 2 superconductors, which have an interesting effect to magnets, that they kind of lock them there are holes in the magnetic fields that are induced by a superconducting material, type 2, and kind of pin the magnetic material in space such that it doesn't just hover. It hovers and stays in particular positions. You can take a magnet and adjust its position with your muscles, and it'll stay in that position because of the pinned magnetic field that sneaks through at small points and stabilizes the magnet that's hovering above the type 2 superconductors. Is that what you're alluding to, or have I just gone off into another subject?
Yes, that's what I'm alluding to, although there are plenty of other related to it. It's magnetic field in plasma under a condition of low resistivity can be frozen. We have also van der Waals, two-dimensional layers of materials, but we're not going to it. But there are plenty of new things that happening right now in magnetism, or in science of magnetism, that could be discussed. We have probably 5 minutes left. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I think those are rather a blue sky and rather deep. I mean, Bose condensates. I mean, you could just keep going on and on and on. There's a lot of little rabbit holes down this path. But, you know, since we only have a few minutes, I don't really think that we have time to give any of these particular esoteric discussions justice.
Yeah, it was Google once. No, it wasn't Google. It was Lexus. Lexus who made a hovering plate, not a plate, hover that person could stand on and actually fly in the air, not far away from the ground, probably 2 or 3 inches. Underneath of that ground, there was a frozen magnet there. Now, when we're talking about van der Waals materials, there are two-dimensional atomic crystals that contain magnetic elements, and those exhibit interesting magnetic properties. So they are very much capable materials that provide ideal platform for exploring magnetism in the two-dimensional limit. And that's the new approach. So we have a film. So we have a very, very, instead of the magnet, we have a very thin film. And then we can pile that film one layer on the other using different properties of the magnetized, differently magnetized layers and having the stack materials from it. So it is being called magnetic van der Waals materials. And to X-ray.
AC2GS. Okay, but, you know, I mean, no one out there is going to start building any of these devices. I mean, again, interesting, esoterica. Maybe it'll come to something practical and useful in everyday life. Maybe not. I mean, for people out there who are fascinated with magnets and the apparent repulsion of magnets, if you don't want to spend a lot of money on superconducting material and liquid nitrogen and all kinds of things like that, there's a very simple demonstration for diamagnetic repulsion. It uses a thin a piece of paralytic carbon, and you put it on alternating magnetic pole cubes, and the pyrolytic carbon levitates about a half, a quarter of a millimeter above the surface of the magnets and just kind of swims over the surface. I think you can get it from China for about $30-$40, and it makes for a very nice display of the principles of diamagnetism in a relatively low-cost, low-maintenance package.
And the last thing, we agreed with Dr. Roy that we're not going to talk about spintronics. The only few words about it is a concept that is over 10 years now, actually since 2009, and started from University of Miami, was carried on by universities in Tokyo and Tohoku in Japan, and a few other institutions. It's a spin transport electronics. The spintronic is the battery that potentially could power the your electromobiles or your cars, and is based on the spin. So it's being called spin battery magnet. For those who are interested, you can go to Spintronics and read about it. We don't know what would be the outcome of it. The last information that I've got was in April 19, 2017, and was very much optimistic. Rechargeable spin battery promising from Spintronics and quantum computing. That's also, let me drop. That is also applicable for quantum computing, the new form of computing. But time for Space Report. N2XGN. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Wesley. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And once again, we didn't get to the radiometer, but what the hell. I'll try again for next Sunday. Just want to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions, you can't get onto the technical net, but you have a question, you'd like it addressed, or if you have a topic you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to hear discussed, or you'd like to be part of a discussion, or you want to ask Paul a question, or if you have a puzzle for me to share with the rest of you, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to get in touch with Paul, that would be spacenetreport@gmail.com. The link page for all kinds of interesting articles. I have a cute little picture at the very, very top of the doorway of Mars. That's available at roy.ac2gs.com. And there's the audio stream available 24/7. Type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, MyKC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv, with archives of this technical net going as far back as September 2006. So thanks, everyone, and I'll be back a little bit later, but right now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with WS2N, Paul.
This is WS2N. And, you know, I don't go by the clock. Roy, if you want to do the radiometry story, that's fine. I know you've been looking to do that for like 3 or 4 weeks now. That's okay, you know. I'll just go later if need be. I don't have all that much anyway. I might not go that late. Back to you.
Well, I don't know how much it'll take, probably a little bit too much. So, you know, give us what you got. If there's a lot of time, I'll come back maybe and do it. We'll see.
Okay. Anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And we start off with launches and landings. And you know, there's a couple of main stories I want to cover, but there is one rocket company, Firefly, that's supposed to be launching a rocket by the end of this month. They tried last September. This is a brand new company. They tried last September. They put their rocket, they call Alper, on the launch pad in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It took off, and they wanted to send it due west. Since it was a test flight, they didn't want this thing anywhere near near L.A. or anything, so they went due west over the Pacific. And they were doing pretty good. First day, stage went. Usually most first tries, they don't get off the launch pad. They abort or something. And they made it out all the way to second stage, and then eventually second stage had a problem. And now they're going to try again, and hopefully they'll attain orbit with this private company, Firefly. With their, it's roughly a 100-foot rocket tall, and it's not a very big rocket, but they expect to be able to put a couple thousand pounds into orbit as a payload. So they have these, they call them reefer engines. It's, you know, kerosene fuel or RP-1 fuel, liquid oxygen. And hopefully that'll work. The more the merrier, more competition. And it's important to be able to launch satellites at will. You know, if something goes wrong up there, with existing satellites, they want to be able to replace them as quickly as possible. Anyway, that was one story I should be, you know, talking about later on in this month. But for now, anybody follows the NASA websites or any of the space websites, unfortunately, it's not on the news much. I saw a little bit on CNN, but this had to do with the Starliner mission that was launched last week, a few days ago, from Florida, Launch Complex 41. That's the one that the ULA uses, the United Launch Alliance, collectively Boeing and Lockheed, launched the Atlas V rocket from that complex. And this time on top of it, they put the Starliner spacecraft. Now, they've done this before, a little over 2 years ago, December 2019, they tried it, the exact same mission, you know, put a Starliner on top, and it didn't work out. You know, they were trying to go to the space station without a crew. It's a test flight. You know, the idea is if successful, that the next flight would be with a crew. Well, 2 years ago, they made it to orbit. There was problems with the computers. The timing didn't match. The spacecraft started using up too much fuel. It thought it was in a different location. Eventually, they deorbited. They had other problems as well. The service module, after separating, came close to the spacecraft itself and almost collided with it. So they worked these problems out. They brought it back and they landed. The thing doesn't land in the water. It lands in New Mexico. You know, to land on land, and you know, it comes down through the atmosphere, heat shield, three parachutes in this case. Heat shield would separate at maybe a bottom, and six gigantic airbags would pop out of the last couple of seconds to soften the landing. So that part all went well. They needed to dock with the spacecraft, with the International Space Station. That is Boeing that makes the Starliner vehicle, designed to carry up to 7 passengers. Once operational, it will be carrying four passengers, similar to what SpaceX has been doing with the Crew Dragon for the last couple of years. In the beginning, there was a competition of which one is going to make it first. Well, because of the problems with Starliner, SpaceX made it first. They've been delivering crews now for 2 years. I think they've gone docked with the space station 4 different times for cruise. And Starline has yet to bring a crew up. But this flight, they wanted to duplicate what they tried to do 2 years ago. They actually tried to do it last August, and they brought the spacecraft out to the Launch Complex 41. They realized the day before that there was problems with the valves on the spacecraft itself.
Paul? Yeah, Paul, I'm trying to get the echo link just popped back. For some odd reason, when you drop out, if I do this, it pops back in. So I just wanted the people on echo link to listen to you as well.
Roy, would it help if I go through Selden instead of Glen Oaks?
I'm not sure. I for the life of me, I think it's a timeout problem, but I can't figure out what's timing out where. I thought actually it was Selden that was the problem, because I thought maybe the link was doing it. If you want to just try a little experiment and try if you can transmit through Selden without it timing out, we could do that.
Okay. Let me turn my antenna around. Right now I'm facing, of course, due west. And we'll turn it around. We'll see what happens. It takes about, I don't know, 20 seconds or so, 20, 30 seconds before it really gets where it's got to go. And it doesn't seem to be going. Well, now it's finally going. Stand by. A little further. Okay, how copy work?
There's about 10% noise on the background.
Really? In other words, I'm... Glen Oaks. This has got to be good, no?
It's a little noisy, but it's fine. It's just a little background crackle.
Okay, that's on. Okay. I think it's the repeater. You know, I'm only about 8 miles from Selden. I have the beam, so I should be dead full quieting. But yeah, maybe there's some flight issues with that. Okay, let me continue with the Starliner story. Anyway, this thing is, the Starliner spacecraft itself is about 15 feet in diameter, so it's a little wider than the Crew Dragon by SpaceX. So they also have more room inside. It's around 90 cubic feet more. And, when it launched, it launched in a different configuration than what Atlas normally launches. Atlas normally will launch, they'll use their standard Russian engine, the RD-180, and then the second stage is the Centaur rocket, which is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. But it's only one rocket. With this crew vehicle, they put two of them on there. So for the second stage, and that all worked very well. The top of the vehicle looks kind of strange, because the diameter of the second stage is roughly 12 feet. A little over 10 feet, and the diameter of the spacecraft is 15 feet, so, I mean, it's a strange-looking setup when you look at the rocket with the spacecraft on top. And because of that big diameter difference, there's airflow problems on the second stage, so they have a skirt below it round skirt that kind of evens things off. And eventually that separates when it goes to orbit. But it all worked fine. I mean, 100% launch. Vehicle got up there, and then they needed to fly it to the International Space Station. That, you know, first stage worked. The solid, they had two solid boosters that came off no problem. And second stage worked fine. And then that separates, and then you just have the spacecraft itself with the service module. Service module is the propulsion, and that pushes the vehicle to the International Space Station roughly 24 hours later, which was yesterday. Yesterday was, correction, yesterday was the opening of the hatch. The day before they docked with the space station. So what was that, Friday, they docked. But to do that, they noticed they had some problems. They're going to have to work out a couple of the thrusters weren't working, but they have backup thrusters. I mean, there's all kinds of rockets all over the spacecraft between the spacecraft itself and the service module, you know, which is located behind it. That part eventually separates before they re-enter. But between the two of them, there's like 62 thrusters of different sizes and different thrust capabilities. If you look at the back, there's four large ones. They're not used. They're never used unless there's an emergency. You know, for instance, if the rocket blew up on launch pad, these four things would light and take the crew away from the explosion, and it would go 1 mile high and 1 mile out to sea. It would come down with a parachute and land in the ocean. And that's the abort system, the launch abort system. That also would work going uphill all the way to orbit. But those four really are never used. But then you have another, like, 20 of these things located on the service module. And then you have another 12 on the spacecraft itself. And then there's another 28 very small thrusters also on the service module to keep the attitude just right, perfect steering and all. So, and some of these are backups. If something goes wrong, the computer switches from one to the other. And everything worked fine, because there were a couple of that thrusters that were not working, and the backups came on, and they'll look into it, you know, after the thing eventually comes back. So they got it close to the space station. They come to within 200 meters, and there's an imaginary sphere around the International Space Station. They come up to it, and then they stop.
Paul?
Yeah, what do I got to do? What do I have to do? Go ahead, Roy. What's up?
Well, the experiment was a failure. It timed out again. It lost your audio again. When I transmitted to you, it came back. I tried all kinds of less severe permutations of kicking it in the side. I tried transmitting through EchoLink. That doesn't seem to do it. For some odd reason, someone transmitting on Glen Oaks kind of resets the audio on EchoLink. I know not why.
Okay, well, we're back on Glen Oaks, Roy. I guess we'll leave it like this for now.
Yeah, I mean, it's up to you if I find it locked out, if you want me to open it up again or just leave it be. It resets eventually. It's just I feel bad for the people listening in on EchoLink.
Okay, on key, are they trying to... You can't tell if they're keying up. Let me just unkey it and see if anybody has anything to say out there. I know Frank's usually listening. This is WS2N for ID. Nothing heard, Roy.
Well, yeah, I mean, most likely they're just listening. The only time they really transmit, unless they have a question, is to talk to each other about what happened to the audio. One of the problems also is something or someone in the background is rekeying the repeater, so that the longest pause that I heard the repeater go for was about 2 or 3 seconds. You have to be really fast on your trigger finger.
Understood. Okay. Anyway, these OMAC thrusters, they will look into them after Starliner eventually gets back to New Mexico, where eventually it's going to land they have 12 of these thrusters, and two of them are giving them a problem. They call them OMAC thrusters, orbital maneuvering and attitude control thrusters. And interesting to watch when it went up, you put on NASA and they'll show the graphics and how many times these thrusters are firing over and over again, to keep it just right as it's coming closer and closer to the space station. And it's all done with a computer, it's all autonomous. They ran some tests. They wanted to be able to see if they needed to abort for any reason as they were going into the space station, on future flights, if they could do it. So they had the astronauts transmit a signal from the space station, which stopped Starliner dead in its tracks, and it actually started backing up. Exactly what it's supposed to do, away from the space station. And then they brought it in close to the space station, up to 10 meters, so roughly 30 feet away, and then it stops again. That's in a program. Mission Control looked at everything. They looked at the pictures. The pictures were just phenomenal. And they could see a little problem they didn't like with the docking ring. It's a docking ring that extends in the front of the spacecraft. So they had Mission Control set the signal, retract the docking ring, and then push the docking ring back out again and see if that cleared the problem, whatever they were looking at. No problem. That took about a half hour. And then they wanted to kill another, I guess, 20, 30 minutes, because they wanted just the right daylight. They didn't want to be in darkness when this thing docked. They could dock in darkness, but this is the first flight for Starliner. They wanted to, have perfect pictures in case there were problems. They needed to know what they were. Anyway, they did successfully soft dock first, and they closed soft dock, and then eventually these pedals start pulling the two spacecraft together until there's a stop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, repeater, timed out. Cancel. Anyway, the two vehicles pull themselves together until there's a tight seal. With that, they waited until the next day, which was yesterday, and there's a vestibule area between the two hatches, so they repressurized that to 14.7 pounds per square inch, the same as what's inside the space station. They happen to use the same pressure that we use here on Earth. And then yesterday afternoon, or I guess probably just after 12 o'clock or so, they went through the process of opening the hatch and got to go inside. First two people that really went inside, was well, there's 7 astronauts on board the space station, but the 2 that they sent in to move some things around and prepare the inside of the new Starliner was two astronauts, and they both happen to be hams. Bob Hines, who's KI5RQT, and Jel Lindgren, he's another ham, KO5MOS. So you have the first two people in to look at this brand new spacecraft and open the door for not only, of course, astronauts, but they were ham radio operators. They have their call signs. So I thought that was pretty good. I sent the picture over to Dr. Roy, and he posted it on his website, and you can see there's two people are running around in red shirts inside the spacecraft. Nice picture taken from one of the cameras inside of the Starliner. And then you see another, looks like a person, in a blue space suit, and it's not a person, but it's Rosie the Rocketeer, an anthropometric mannequin. Anyway, this thing is got all kinds of sensors all over it. This way they know all the G-forces and the thermal temperatures and the humidity and everything that an astronaut would normally experience on a way uphill and all the way to docking. So, and the reason they call it Rosie the Rocketeer, it's named after Rosie the Riveter, of fame in World War II, of the women that would be, putting airplanes together in factories. So they honored that group. Let me drop it. Starliner will be traveling back to Earth. Planned date is Wednesday. So they needed around 5 days. They brought up like 600 pounds worth of stuff, which isn't much. Normally a cargo vehicle would bring up, 6,000 pounds worth of stuff or more. The HTV by Japan would bring up 12,000 pounds. But on any crew flight, even when the crews start going up, that's, what they would bring up, 200-400 pounds worth of stuff. In this case, it was around 600 pounds of stuff. On the way back, they're going to bring back around 500 pounds of equipment that needs to be brought back to NASA, including some oxygen, not oxygen, air tanks. They send up nitrogen and oxygen rechargeable tanks when the shuttles retired. They had these things, there were like 4 of them attached to each shuttle. So they saved them, they took them out and they used them, today, and they pumped these things up to many thousands of pounds of pressure. I forgot, I think 3,000-4,000 pounds of pressure. And they send them up to the space station every now and then on different cargo vehicles. SpaceX has brought them up, and HTV has brought them up. Cygnus, another cargo vehicle, has brought them up. And every once in a while, they bring them back down and recharge them on Earth and send them back up to the space station in the future. So, I don't know. Anybody have any questions? By the way, if anybody has any questions that I could look into, for instance, for next week, you could always email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Any questions or comments before we continue? WS2N. Nothing hard. I think I left enough time for for EchoLink. You know, years ago, one of Dick K2RIW's favorite topics was Voyager spacecraft. And we haven't really talked about Voyager that much lately. But sure enough, it was in the news recently. Voyager 1 is having a problem. Sending back information saying that its attitude or, you know, direction in space is a little off one way or the other. The problem is it can't be off because the signals are being received and transmitted to and from Voyager 1 with no problem. So they are looking into that. But it may, you know, made me realize that, you know, we haven't talked about the two of them, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Voyager 1 is further away than Voyager 2. And it's around 130 AU. AU is astronomical unit. One astronomical unit is the distance between the sun and Earth. So if you multiply that times 130 times, that's where Voyager 2 is, and this one's Voyager 1 that's having a problem, and that's 155. AU. So, you know, we all know, you know, at the speed of radio waves, you know, 2 seconds to the moon, you know, 20 minutes or so to Mars, you know, that type of thing. One way to Voyager 1 is now 21 hours. So let's say you want Voyager 1 to do something. You send the signal out, wait 21 hours, and then it gets there. It does what it's got to do, and sends the signal back. So, you know, each communication, you know, is roughly 2 days. That's really something. So that gives me a good idea of how far this thing is away. I think it's roughly 3 or 4 times now the distance of Pluto. Pluto is roughly 39 AU. Let's call it 40 AU. So, you know, you're getting out there close to 4 times the distance for Voyager 1. Anyway, they seem to be working on the problem. They're dealing with old technology, but they still have the capability of communicating with Voyager 1 and 2. And it's still sending science back, you know, data about the plasma and all. You know, the cameras and everything have stopped working. The power system runs on the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. They each have 3. Each one puts out roughly 109 watts of power. And that's what they use to charge batteries all these years. Anyway, to keep it going, they tend to lose around 4% of power per year. You know, not so much electrical power, but the heat that's generated that they use to heat up these thermocouples. They have thermocouples in series in parallel. That's what gives them their 28 volts.
This is Craig Casey,
Heat is down that are no longer needed to keep something warm.
Yeah, it's there.
As long as that traveling wave tube,
the
25 watts, I think that's way down in power now, probably around 18 watts now transmitting power to make it through the through space all the way from 155 AU. That's pretty amazing.
Casey,
all of that work.
1973, California.
So, okay. That's the story on Voyager. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Anyway, another mission I followed quite a few years is the InSight mission. InSight mission went to Mars a few years ago, landed there, I think 2018 or so, and it was planned on lasting, you know, no more than 2 years, so they did get an extension out of it. The idea was it wasn't a rover, they just landed in one place, you know, roughly the equator area, a place called Ellipsum Plantea, and it's been there since 2018, and its mission was to figure out what's going on under the surface of Mars. So it had two main instruments. It had a seismometer, which was located on the spacecraft, and they needed to put it on the ground, so they had a robotic arm that lifted this thing up, placed it on the ground, and it had a cover over it to make sure there's no wind or dust that would get on the instruments. And, you know, very light wind on Mars, but they didn't want any wind. It would affect the instruments. It's so sensitive. And this thing picks up Mars quakes. And according to what I just read, they total around 1,300 Mars quakes since the landing of InSight. And recently, and just recently, they picked up the largest quake, they call it a number 5. Whether that's similar to a number 5 here on Earth, I don't think so. But they list them in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and most of them been like 3s or 4s. And this was the biggest one. And scientists are very happy to get this. Once they get that, it also, you know, it's so loud, or such a vibration is so big that it sends another wave, goes from one end of Mars to the other, and then comes back. When it comes back, through that process, they're able to figure out the different things that are underneath the surface of Mars, just from the Mars quake. So they're very happy to get that information in, because InSight is on its way out. I don't think it's going to last another 6 months. And the reason for it is because of the Martian dust. Over time, Martian dust starts to accumulate on the panels. We had that problem with Spirit and Opportunity, the two Mars rovers that one of them drove around for 14 years. The other one was around 6.5 years, Spirit. But, you know, you build up dust, and eventually, you know, that would cut back on the amount of power that could be delivered to the spacecraft driving around. And the number would get so low, they'd have to shut systems down and hope for a breeze to go by. Which actually happened a couple of times, a little dust bubble or a breeze would go by, and eventually the panels would be cleared off. And they have never had that kind of luck with InSight, you know. I mean, it landed, and it's just getting dustier and dustier. And, you know, from what I read, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to run InSight much longer. The other instrument that they had on board that spacecraft was a heat probe. They call it HP3. This heat probe was supposed to pound itself into the surface and go 15 feet under the ground. And this thing couldn't get 15 centimeters under the ground. You know, I mean, they tried, went a couple inches. They tried everything. They had the scoop, the robotic arm they were pushing down on the top, trying to hold it steady while this thing pounds itself into the ground. It had a weight on the inside, so a weight and a spring. So the motor would turn, and it was like a cam. It would turn this weight, and the weight would rise further up and further up, being pushed against the spring. And then once it released off the cam, it would shoot straight down. And it was a weight, and it would hit the inside of this probe, and, you know, do it thousands of times. and it was supposed to eventually get, you know, 15 feet or 3 meters into the surface. Never happened. And unfortunately, Germany was not happy about that. Germany, DLL space program, designed that whole setup, and it did not work. So I guess they're looking for eventually to get a ride on another mission someday in the future. Any comments or questions on InSight or any of the other couple of topics I've discussed? Nothing heard. There's EVA suits on board the space station. Space suits to go for spacewalks, extravehicular activities. And over the years, these things are getting older. And then, over the years, they've now started to have a couple of problems. In 2013, they had a serious problem with water getting into the spacesuit. I remember talking about this on the net quite a bit. Luca Pamitano, an astronaut from the European Space Agency, was on the station, and he's a ham, by the way, as well. He's called KF5KDP, and he was doing a spacewalk, and the water got into his visor, to his eyes, possibly eventually into his nose, and, you know, they didn't go into a panic. They just canceled the EVA. The word terminated, which means, okay, just put your stuff away and just get back to the, you know, to the airlock, to the Quest lab. That's where they go in and out of the International Space Station, you know, as soon as you can. And they didn't have an abort. An abort would be just leave your tools, bag, wires, cables, everything, and just bail out, you know. But I think it was very close to an abort because he was having some trouble seeing. They always send out 2 astronauts at a time. So one could always help the other one. It's a real buddy system. Anyway, they got him back, and they realized that, you know, there was problems with water getting into the system. And water could come from a couple of different places. You know, everything from sweating to leaky systems that they're running through their bodies, the external parts of their bodies, trying to keep themselves warm or cool, and most likely came from that. But they've really never nailed it down. They've had a couple of other problems, and then recently, one of the last EVAs, they had another similar problem. They noticed when they taking the helmet off. Well, actually, before they did it, they was having another astronaut taking the helmet off, helping them. And they said, you know, usually the one guy goes first and then the other guy. They said, this guy's got water, and let's do this right away. You know, you never know, it might be a problem. So they found, you know, maybe half a cup of water in there. Doesn't sound like much, but, you know, with no gravity, that stuff gets into your eyes, nose, or something. You know, especially your eyes, you can't see where you're going, and you got to translate all the way back to the Quest lab. You know, you might be hundreds of feet away. You know, the space station is like over the length of a football field. So they're working on it. They want to find out what the problem is. They're sending that same space suit now back on a Crew Dragon cargo vehicle. You know, so that's the plan, to bring that back and see what the story is. So right now, all EVAs on the American side and the European Space Station side are canceled, unless, you know, they feel that there's something that needs to be fixed, maybe an ammonia leak or something like that. They'll make an approval to go out and do an EVA. But all your regular EVAs, they have power upgrades that they need to do. Temporarily cancel until they really determine what the problem is, where this water is coming from, and how to stop it, or how to mitigated